Okay, we are in business. The moment I hit record, everybody goes silent. Nobody wants to be on the recording. So the truth is, I record Monday morning, so I don't really need to record Wednesday. Okay, whatever. It is what it is. So we spent last week kind of just reading through the text of the story of David and Bathsheba. Kind of a cursory fact of what is described, what is actually happening. And it's a complicated story. It's a very long story for Tanakh terms. It's a story that's two chapters long, which is actually quite large. And it is filled with back and forth and different personalities that we have to walk through, the world of David and the world of Bathsheba and Uriah and Yoav and Nathan, of course, who pulls it all together. So each one of these is a different perspective and a different angle to the complexity of the story. And we will kind of reconvene and go through it piece by piece. But we came away with a class, sort of a takeaway that I wanted to have last week, was two core questions. One is overall the question of how we understand David's behavior, which is so out of character for David. And what exactly did he do and why did he do it? And was it just a temptation and a moment of weakness, or was there some other calculation, and what exactly was going through his mind? And then the cover-up and the attempt to have for Uriah kind of cover up and then have Uriah killed. All of that is so extraordinarily out of character for David. And at the same time, Nathan's critique of David is both harsh, extraordinary, but also somewhat odd, because on the one hand, he comes with this mashal and he starts the story about two people, and then he shifts to the issue of marrying Bathsheba rather than to the issue of the affair that he has with Bathsheba. And so the issue of his initial relationship, initial night with Bathsheba, is ignored by the Navi. And he keeps focusing on the fact that he marries Bathsheba. And yet the Navi sanctions that marriage and even blesses the child that comes, not the immediate child, but the subsequent child, Shlomo, gets the kind of divine stamp of approval from the Navi and from God. So all around, the story is missing huge pieces and chunks of information. And we have a lot to cover over the course of the year in terms of understanding. What I wanted to do this evening, however, is this evening and probably next week as well, is kind of take a step back from the story itself and look at the overall context of how we approach biblical exegesis and interpretation. This is really one of the most intense moments, places where the debate amongst the Mefarshim as to how to approach Tanakh overall takes place and gets polarized and polemicized because of the intensity around the personality of David HaMelech. So what is a small debate in other places becomes a major debate here. But it's a very good segue for us to kind of review a approach to Midrashim overall, and to Chazal, and to Parshanut, and to Machloket of the Mefarshim, and how the interplay between interpretation, text, and Parshanut. And that's really where, especially because so much of our perspective on the story of David and Bathsheba has to be taken both from the perspective of the text, but also from the perspective of Jewish tradition, then we really need to understand this subject as a kind of a subunit of the overall discussion. And so what I wanted to do this evening, and we'll probably do it over two classes, is to look at some of the core rabbinic statements related to the text, particularly this one passage in the Gemara and Shabbos, which is this text that everybody refers to, and use it as a kind of a jumping point for an understanding of how the Rishonim and how the Mefarshim understand Pshat versus Drash. How do we relate to text and how do we relate to rabbinic interpretation of text? So what I want to do is we're going to leave this page here with Sefer Shmuel for the rest of this evening, and I'm going to share with you this source page. This source page is also posted on the website, the Shul website, where I have all the shiurim, audio shiurim posted, has the source pages as well. If you want, I will post it in the chat also. So anybody who wants to download it, you're welcome to. All right, so it's now in the chat as well. All right. So the story that we're going to address, or the issue, the midrash, the rabbinic statement that we're going to look at, is a Gemara in Shabbos that is a lengthy piece. It's actually very, for midrashic sources, it's actually quite long. It's a series of statements of Shmuel ben Nachmeni in the name of Rabbi Yonatan. We looked at it, I think it was the last year or the year before. We've seen pieces of it in the past related to other stories in Tanakh. And it relates to six different episodes in Tanakh. And so part of our eventually we'll come back to this piece because I want to ask the question, what is in common with each of these six places in Tanakh that this statement or this insight is offered? Rav Shmuel Nachmeni, in the name of Yonatan, refers to six different episodes in Tanakh. The first is the story of Reuben and Bilhah. The second is the story of the children of Eli, Chafni and Pinchas. The third is the children of Shmuel. The fourth is David. The fifth is Shlomo HaMelech. And the sixth is Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu, a little bit of is an exception. I'm going to leave Yoshiyahu for now. But the other ones are fairly easy to see. They're all stories or relate to moments of what the text would describe as very sordid activity or episodes. Meaning, the pasuk by Reuven and Bilhah is Reuven, son of Yaakov. The pasuk says that Vayishkav et Bilhah pilegesh aviv, that after the death of Rachel, Bilhah went and slept with Bilhah, his father's Pilegesh. And so that clearly is a very problematic statement. Similarly with B'nai Eli, we have similar kinds of, and that's where we spent a lot of time talking about this, the story of beginning of Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph, the story of the sons of Eli. So here's what the Gemara says. Everybody with me? Just nod your head. We're good? All right. Amar Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachmeni, Amar Rabbi Yonatan. And the author of these six statements is the same in each case. Shmuel ben Nachmeni, in the name of Rabbi Yonatan. Kol ha'omer Reuven chata eino ela to'e. Anyone who says that Reuven sinned is mistaken. As it says, Vayu b'nei Yaakov shnemasa. Yaakov's children numbered 12, which is actually the pasuk right after the description of Reuven's chet. This teaches that they are all of equal stature, 12 of equal stature. If that's true, says the Gemara, what do I do with the pasuk that says that Reuven went and slept with his father's Pilegesh Bilhah? How do I? Are you telling me that if I say he sinned, that's a mistake, and yet the text says he did this? Says Rav Shmuel ben Nachmeni, milamed shebilbel mitzo shel aviv. He didn't lay with Bilhah. He simply moved her bed. He moved Yaakov's bed, I should say. He went and, in the aftermath of Rachel's death, Yaakov wanted to choose to move his primary residence in with Rachel's maidservant, and Reuven felt that that was inappropriate, belongs to Leah, his mother, And so he moved Yaakov's couch. But because he was interfering with the intimacy between Yaakov and his wives, the text considers it as if Reuven slept with Bilhah, his father's Pilegesh. And the rest of this story is exactly a sort of expansion of that discussion, which we'll eventually come back to. I want to kind of look from a bird's eye view at all six cases of Shmuel Nachmani's statement. Next case where he makes a similar statement is in the story of Bnei Eli. So Bnei Eli is the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph. Eli is the Kohen Gadol. His two children, Chafni and Pinchas, are there serving as Kohanim. They're eventually the reason why the Mishkan and Shiloh is destroyed. Text describes them as Bnei Beliyah lo yadu at Hashem, worthless people of immoral stature. And this is what Shmuel ben Nachmani says about them. Amar Shmuel ben Nachmani, Amar of Yonatan, Kol ha'omer b'nei Eli chatu eino ela to'eh. Anyone who says that b'nei Eli sinned is mistaken. As it says, V'sham shnei b'nei Eli chofni u'pinchas, kohanim la'ashem. Chofni u'pinchas are serving as kohanim to God. Can't be that they committed the crime that the text ascribes to them. What does that mean? Several kirav, amarav, pinchas lochata, makish chafni lepinchas, ma pinchas lochata, chafni lochata. That's a separate limud. I'm going to skip that for a second. For now, elamani mekayem ashi yishkvunet anashim. What do I do with the pasuk that says that they slept with the women? I need to show you this pasuk because we won't understand what the Gemara is referring to without it. So, I'm going to jump to. Sorry, that should be Shmuel Aleph. Perek Bet. Pasuk says, Ve'eli zaken ma'od. Eli was getting on in years. This is a whole book before. This is Shmuel Aleph. Sorry. Ve'eli zaken ma'od. Mishamat asher ya'asun banav l'cho Yisrael. He heard that which his children were doing to Israel, that asher yishkevun et hanashim hatzovot petachom moed, and how they lay with the women that served, that brought, or that gathered at the door of the tent of meeting. So, says Rav Shmuel ben Nachmani, kol ha'omer b'nei Eli chatu eino lo to'eh. If you say they sinned, you're mistaken. So what do I do with this pasuk that says that they took the women who were coming to the temple and to the tabernacle and slept with them? Says the Gemara, mitoch sheshanu sheshahu et kinehen shelochu etzal ba'alayen ma'aleh alav ha'kutuv ki'ilu shechavun. Because they delayed bringing, they procrastinated or delayed or postponed or ignored the offerings of the women after childbirth or after tumah, were required to bring a offering of a nest of birds, and Chofni Pinchas, because of their feeling that there wasn't enough meat on the birds for their own personal satisfaction, they prefer to bring the korbanot, the people who were bringing cows and goats and what have you, but these bird offerings didn't offer much for the Kohanim, so they put them at the back of the line. That's more or less the insight of Shmuel ben Nachmani. And because they were, again, interfering in the intimacy of these women with their husbands, the text considers it as if they were guilty of having an affair with each of them. So, in a sense, a very similar kind of approach to the story of Reuben and Bill. Okay, next case, B'nai Shmuel. All right, let's go to the text for a second and just see the case here as well. This is Perek Chet. When Shmuel was getting old, he set his sons as judges over Israel. Two sons, Yoel and Aviah, in Beersheba, v'lo chuban habitvachav. His sons did not walk in the way of their father. They took bribes, or looked for Betzah's prophet. They took bribes, they perverted justice. And the rest, as they say, is history. The people came to Shmuel and said, we want a king. All right, so what do you think Rav Shmuel Nachmani, in the name of Rav Yonasan, is going to say about Bnei Shmuel?
I can't believe that Shmuel's sons did that.
Yeah, no, that's
disappointing. I know you've known that for a long time, but I'm saying I just saw that here and I'm kind of surprised.
That's a story that we dealt with in Shmuel Aleph, but that was a long time ago. So Shmuel Aleph for us was like 5 years ago. Shmuel ben Achmeni, Omer of Yonatan, or more, six. If you think that Bnei Shmuel sinned, you are mistaken. It says that the children didn't walk in their father's footsteps. To say somebody didn't walk in their father's footsteps means that they weren't quite as great as their father. That doesn't mean that they did terrible things like perverting justice and taking bribes. You wouldn't describe such a person as not walking in Shmuel's footsteps. You describe him as an oisvar, or as a wicked person, or other descriptions. But to say they didn't walk in their father's footsteps, they weren't as great as Shmuel. They were corrupt and they took bribes and they were, it's disconnected. They went for a prophet. They were not quite as diligent as their father. Shmuel the tzaddik, he went from city to city. He was like the itinerant judge. He literally went from north to south throughout the country to go to the people to judge and to offer his services to them wherever they were. As it says, he went literally throughout the whole country. Whereas Bnei Shmuel, they didn't do that. They sat in Beersheba, as the text said at the beginning, so that those people would come to Beersheba and they'd have to pay. They'd have to pay the rental fee, and they'd have to pay for the chazan and for the shamash and the balab and the guard at the all kinds of fees. There's a legal fee, and there's an entrance fee, and there's a chazan fee, and there's a shamash fee, and there's right. So you have to all kinds of fees. That's not corrupt. That's just fees. Says the Gemara that this is in fact a machloket tanoim. One says vaituach ha'batza v'meir omer chalkam shalu b'fiem. That they asked, when it says that they took bribes, means that they wanted money. Profit means that they asked for their share. They asked to be paid. I'm not going to get into all these opinions. It gets into too much. But there's a whole discussion here as to whether or not they, in fact, were guilty of bribes and corruption or not. Shulman Nachmani clearly says that they were not. Okay. Skip David for a second. We'll come back to David last because it's the most complicated of all of these. And as you can see, it's also the longest. And let's just jump to Shlomo HaMelech for a second. Now, Shlomo HaMelech, let's also do a quick review. Malachim Aleph.
Who wrote Shmuel Aleph?
Shmuel Aleph was written most likely by Shmuel up until the point of Shmuel's death. After that, I don't think Shmuel wrote anymore.
So he didn't write the part that his sons took bribes and stuff? He did.
Yes, that's in that section. Malachim Aleph, Perek, Yud Aleph. Shlomo HaMelech loved many foreign women, meaning he had wives, many foreign wives from all kinds of nations. Bat Paro, Moaviot, Amoniot, Adamiot, Sanadoniot, Chitoyot, all kinds of different regional powers and neighbors. He married, as we know, 300 wives and 700 concubines. Shlomo HaMelech had quite a harem. From the very nations that God said, don't marry them because they will lead your heart astray, Shlomo HaMelech married them. That's the very famous statement in Chazal, that Shlomo HaMelech thought he could outsmart the prohibitions of the Torah. He was, in a sense, too smart for his own good. Ba'ilu nashim sarot shvamiot, upilachim shloshmiot, he had 700 wives, 300 concubines. Okay. Vayatuna shavat libo. And his wives turned his heart astray. Ba'ilu edzik nat shlomo, as Shlomo HaMelech became old, nashavitu et levavo, his wives turned his heart astray, achare alim acherim, to follow other gods, v'lo haya levavo shalem im Hashem alokav kilevav David aviv, his heart was not whole with God, as was the heart of David, his father. Shlomo followed the path of Ashtoreth, god of Sidon, and Milkom, Molech, the god of Ammon. He did evil in the eyes of God, and he did not fully go after God's ways, as did David, his father. Then Shlomo built an altar for Kmosh, the god of Moab, and he built an altar to Molech, the god of Ammon. And so he did for all his foreign wives, so that they could offer and sacrifice to their gods. He built a temple for Kmosh in the outside of Yerushalayim, and he built a temple to Molech outside of the temple, and he built a temple for Ashtoreth, and whatever his wives wanted, Shlomo gave them. God was angry at Shlomo because he turned his heart away from God, who had appeared to him and spoken to him twice, Shlomo, and yet he did this. That's what it says about Shlomo. So what does Rav Shmuel Nachmeni say? Amr Rav Shmuel Nachmeni, Amr Rav Nanatan, Kol Omer Shlomo Chata Eino Ela To'eh. Anyone who says Shlomo sinned is mistaken. As it says, V'lo haya levavo shalim im Hashem elokav kilevav David aviv. Shlomo's heart was not whole with God as was the heart of David, his father. Meaning, similar lesson that he took earlier, a similar approach. To say that somebody didn't walk in David's footsteps. Okay, so he wasn't as great as David. That doesn't mean that he was an idolater, that he worshipped idols. What do I do with the text that says that his women pulled his heart astray and led him to build altars to other idols? He could have been asked, I'm a Rabbi Nassan. The Rabbi Nassan Rami, Rabbi Nassan asked this as a question. On the one hand, it says, on the one hand, it says that his wives caused his heart to go astray. On the other hand, it says, that he didn't go, he wasn't like his father, but it doesn't mean that he was as bad as others. So what do I do with this text? It says that these wives led his heart astray to go after other idols, meaning to go, but they wanted to pull him, but he didn't actually do it. They got him up to the point, but then he backed out. It says, Shlomo built an altar to the gods of Moab. He wanted to build it, but he didn't actually build it. He kind of, this was his desire. He wanted to, but he didn't actually do it. Okay. What do I do with the pasuk that says, Vayash Shlomo Rabbi Nei Hashem, he did evil in the eyes of God?
Because
because he should have been stronger in his objection to the efforts of his wives to bring idolatry into the capital, the cultural process of his wives, he wasn't strong enough to stop them. The text considers it as if he was guilty of these sins. Okay, and then the last case of Yeshayahu, we're going to skip for now, but similar kind of issue with Yeshayahu. So the pattern to all of these, by the way, if you notice, is that there's a very clear text that says they sinned. Shmuel Nachmeni, who kind of attempts to lower the temperature. No, didn't really. But then the text says that they sinned, so they have to find some other fault and then say, Ma'aleh Rav HaKatuv Ke'ilu. That the text would consider it as if he was, as if they did X, Y, and Z, even though they really didn't. Okay. So what does he say about David? That's the most intriguing for us. Amar Rav Shmuel Nachmeni, Amar Rav Yonas. Kol Omer David Chata Eino Ela To'eh. Anyone who says David sinned is mistaken. Shne'emar, Vahi David Lachol D'Rachav Maskil V'Hashem Imo. David, in all of his ways, was successful, and God was with him. Says Shmuel Nachmeni, Efsher Chet Bali Ado V'Shchina Imo. Is it possible that the Torah, the text, would describe as God is with him, even though he did these terrible things? So what do I do with the pasuk Alamani Mekayem Madua Bazita Dvar Hashem Lasot Hara? Natan the Navi said to David, why did you despise God's words to do this evil thing? That sounds to me like the Navi considered it as if he sinned. Says the Gemara, Shebikesh la'asot v'lo'asa. David wanted to do it, but he held himself back, and he didn't. So he was being held accountable for his desire, not for his actions. Says the Gemara, Amarav, Rebbe, the Ati mi David, Mahapech v'darish b'zchute de David. Rav, an Amora, first generation Amora, says of Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, redactor of the Mishnah, that Rebbe, who is a descendant of David HaMelech, right, is a descendant of Hillel HaZaken, Rebbe, the Asi mi David, he's a descendant of David, sought to interpret the text in accordance with that which would be beneficial to David's reputation. There's an interesting discussion in the Rishonim, in the Mefarshim, whether or not what Rav was saying about Rebbe was positive or critical. Was he saying about Rebbe that Rebbe, who we're going to see, follows the same line of thinking in Rav Shmuel Nachmeni, that Rebbe, because he was a descendant of David, was able to see an insight into David that reflected a positive picture that we wouldn't have otherwise been able to identify? Or is he saying that Rebbe was biased in his interpretation because he was a descendant of Rebbe, of David? He wanted David to come out less guilty than would otherwise have been perceived. It's a this debate amongst the commentaries. Says the Gemara, what did Rebbe say about David? Madua, the pasuk says, Madua basita dvar Hashem lasot hara, you despised God to do this evil thing, says Natan to David. Rebbe Omer, says Rebbe, Mishuna ra'azu mikora ot shabbat hara. This statement, so-and-so did evil, is different than every other reference to somebody doing evil. Shekol ra'ot shabbat hara k'tiv bahu vayas. In every other case, it says they did evil, vayas hara b'nei Hashem. Here it says that they wanted the lasot to do. Why did you despise God to do lasot? Meaning, bikesh lasot v'lasa. He wanted to, but he didn't. He held back. He stopped one step early. Problem. The pasuk says that Natan said to David that he's guilty not only for marrying Bathsheba, but also for killing Uriah. Pasuk says, David said, Nathan said to David, "Et Uriah chiti kita b'charev." You killed Uriah by the sword. So what do you do with that pasuk? Says Rebbe, "Sheyalach al aduno b'Sanhedrin b'lo danta." If you felt that he was guilty of a crime for which there was a capital offense and which there was a death penalty, you should have brought him to the Sanhedrin and have him judged in front of the court and not judged him yourself. Okay, that's his sin, but not that he actually killed him. What about the fact that the pasuk says, and you took his wife as your wife, et ishto lakachta lecha leisha? Says the Gemara, yeah, it says you took his wife, lakachta, meaning likuchen yeshba, that it's a valid marriage. Natan, in that statement, validated David's marriage to Bathsheba because he called it marriage. You married Bathsheba. If he didn't think the marriage was legal, he would have said, you took Bathsheba. But he says, you married Bathsheba. That says that marriage was legal. How could it be legal if she was married when David had his one-night affair with him and became pregnant from him, and she was married to Uriah Chiti at the time, right? But it was before Uriah died. So how could it be legal? And here comes the key piece of Shmuel Nachmeni's statement. To Amr Rabbi Shmuel Nachmeni, Amr Rabbi Yonatan, Kol Ayotzei Lemochemet Beit David, Kotev Get Kritut Liishto. Practice standard in the army of David HaMelech, says of Shmuel Nachmeni, that all the soldiers before they went to war, they wrote their wives a get. Why do they write their wives a get? That's machloket in the Gemara, multiple opinions. Some say it was to prevent any cases of aguna. Others say it was to prevent any cases of yibum. Others suggest that it was valid right away. Some suggest that the get wasn't valid until they died, and then it was valid retroactively. All discussion in the Rishonim, what this get is about. But the Gemara's statement was that therefore, when David took Bathsheba that fateful night in Yerushalayim, technically she wasn't married at that time because she had this get from Uriah.
Can I ask a question, please?
You may ask a question. I don't promise an answer right now, but you may certainly ask. Go ahead.
So if that was the case, that she wasn't married to Uriah, why did he have to have Uriah killed?
That is a good question. I'm intentionally not going to answer it, only because, and I apologize for that, there's so many levels to this that we're going to have to weave back into the story and go back to the text. Isn't in fact the case that she wasn't married at the time? What is the status of such a get? How did David see it? How did the people see it? Was Uriah, Gemara says that Uriah, we'll see in a second, that Uriah, according to David, was guilty of a different crime altogether, that he had him killed for something else, not for, right? What this means, and we have to come back to the question of Pshat in the story, so... there's a lot of work. That's why I'm doing this step by step. But it is a very powerful question, and it's in fact the question that Gemara anticipates, because the next line is you killed Uriah with the sword of Bnei Amon, so it says he's guilty of murder. Says Rabbi, Ma Chere Bnei Amon Iyatan Nashalav, you David are not guilty for the sword of Amon. Sword of Ammon is a war. There are lots of people who die in war. You're a king, you have an army, you're at war with Ammon, so people are going to die. You're not guilty for Uriah's death because he was killed by Bnei Ammon. My time, well, why not? Says Gemara, because, says Rabbi, Uriah Chiti was guilty of a capital offense. What was the capital offense? Insubordination or treason. How is Uriah guilty of treason? Because Uriah, in his response to David, when David said to him, why don't you go home? Uriah's response was, Adoni Yoav Avdei Adoni al Pnei Asadachonim. Pnei Asadachonim. My master Yoav and my master's servants are encamped on the field, ready to battle, and I'm going to go home to my wife. But by calling Yoav his master, Yoav is the general. David is the king. That is an insubordination. That is treason. And that, says the Gemara, was why David had him killed. Says the final line of the Gemara, Amarav, ki ma'ainid be David l'mashkachas be'bar med Uriah, t'chtiv rak b'dva Uriah. Bottom line is I have this series of statements, Shmur Menachmeni, in six different places in Tanakh, where the text clearly indicates that on the simple reading of the text, so-and-so committed a very sordid kind of activity that was either idolatrous or adulterous or murderous, right? If you take the big three, Gilui Arayah, Shvichas Damim, and Avodah Zarah, the big three, that's what you've got here. Reuven guilty of Gilui Arayah, David guilty of Gilui Arayah, and Shvichas Damim. This is major stuff. And she comes along with Shmuel Nachmani in each of these instances and says, no, you're misreading it. Don't read it superficially. Don't take it at face value. Kol ha'omer ploni chata eino ela to'eh. If you say so-and-so sinned, you are mistaken. This Maimer Chazal, this Gemara of the story of Shmuel Nachmani lies at the epicenter of the polemic around Midrashim and how literal to take Midrashim in and how binding are Midrashic interpretations in our interpretation or approach to study Tanakh. This is the center of this debate. So I think it's worth stopping here, looking at this Gemara and looking at the approaches we find in the Rishonim to dealing with Midrash as a whole, which we're going to do tonight, and then next week, zero in on the approach to this particular Midrash and how it fits into the story.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So I'm having a little trouble with David, that he says he really didn't sin when the text says, Ani chatati, I sinned. I mean, David admitted that he sinned. So how can he say that if we think he sinned, we're wrong and he really didn't sin?
Fair question. Amongst the many.
Okay.
Right? We're not going to, again, I want to divide this into two parts. One is to use this as a segue to understand a broader question, which is how do we deal with Chazal in their interpretation of text? Are we assuming that Rav Shmuel Nachmani is simply whitewashing biblical personalities and anytime we find somebody in the text who sinned, he's going to say, no, they didn't? Is Rav Shmuel Nachmani really saying that they didn't sin when the text says that they did? Or is there something else going on, number one? Number two, in general, am I bound, if I want to teach the story of David, am I bound morally, legally, halachically, philosophically to by this approach of Shmuel ben Nachmani in my understanding of Tanakh? How binding, how much of a straitjacket does Shmuel ben Nachmani's interpretation place over our study of the story of David and Bathsheba? That's at the core of it. That's the bigger question, because at some level, I could turn around and say, that's Rosh Hashanah Nachmani's opinion. He's entitled to his opinion. I'm entitled to mine. He says one thing and I say something else. I say, I'll take the text literally. And he says, I can't take this text literally. How binding is this statement? Is this approach? This is at the core, one of the biggest debates in Parshanut that goes back from the time of the Gaonim until modern times. So we're talking about a debate that has raged within the commentaries of Tanakh for the last 1500 years. And what I wanted to show you is this springboard first, and then kind of take a look at some of the extreme opinions. How do we navigate this? Ezrat Hashem, next week, we'll narrow the scope and look at this particular question of this Maamar Chazal, and then we'll begin to go back to the text and see where it leads us. So in general, dealing with these kinds of midrashim, I would say there are three approaches. Okay. One is simply to ignore them and say, Chazal are Gemara, Shmuel Ben Achmeini, Rav Yonatan, Rav, Rebbe, all of these personalities. They don't know the first thing about biblical interpretation. They're all wrong, or they're all talking about Musar and moral issues, etc. They're not talking about text. They're not talking about Parshanut. Or I'm not bound by it. My goal is to seek text. Totally irrelevant to me how they saw it. I'm just going to analyze the text on my own. That's one possibility. Ignore the Medrash, just look at the text, just look at the story, and see where it gets me. Not an approach that I am 100% comfortable with, for many reasons, not the least of which, so we are, as Orthodox Jews, we are anchored in the world of Chazal in every aspect of our lives. We live by Chazal's interpretation of halacha. We live by Judaism, both biblical and rabbinic. We live by the Gemara. We study the Gemara all day long. Right? That's the anchor of Jewish life. And so to kind of bifurcate it and say, okay, well, we are bound by it, but when it comes to interpretation of Tanakh, we couldn't care less what Chazal have to say. That's already a stretch that is problematic for us. The flip side is, and I share with you one source, there are many, but I'll share with you one contemporary source. The flip side is articulated by the Chazon Ish, who writes the following. Mishorsheha emuna, it is a foundation of our faith. Shekolan emar begemara, anything that appears in the Talmud, ben b'mishnah, ben b'gemara, whether it be in the Mishnah, whether it be in the Gemara, ben b'alacha, ben b'agadah, whether it be in halachic material or whether it be in homiletic or agadic material or midrashic material. Hey, mehem advarim shenitkalu lano ayedei koach nevu'i, shukoach nishika shel esech la'netzal, their words are close to prophecy as we're going to get. And therefore, we are totally bound by every word that appears in the Gemara. We are frightened. We are trembling. We are step. We are shaken by that which we hear of those who question the words of Chazal. Ben ba'alacha uven ba'agada, whether it be in halachic material, whether it be in agadic or midrashic material, kishmua shel giduf. This has the characteristic of heresy, to question Chazal's interpretation of anything, whether it be halachic or agadic, is unacceptable. And within the world of halacha, as Orthodox Jews, we are bound in total by the words of the rabbis and the Talmud in literal interpretation, both in halacha and in agada. That is basically an approach that exists within the a certain, let's call it a cross-section of the population of the Jewish world today, that takes midrashic material, agadic material, and halachic, talmudic material in equal level, at equal face value. And therefore, if we are bound by Chazal in terms of their halachic interpretations, rabbinically, then we are also bound by their agadic or midrashic interpretation. No different. That's the approach. The Chazon Ish is one articulation of it, but you find it in many places, Dessler in Michta Melio and others as well. So at my two extremes, I have the opinion that says, we are not bound by Chazal at all. We can have total freedom to look at text and say what we want. And on the other hand, I have those like the Chazon Ish who say, we are totally bound by the literal meaning of whatever Chazal say, that interpretation is the only interpretation that we have to offer to the text in front of us. I think it probably goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that I am, and I'm sure we all are, somewhat uncomfortable with either of these two extreme opinions, especially with regards to stories like Shmuel ben Nachmeni, Bnei Eli, Shlomo, some foundational stories in Tanakh. To be bound by this literal reading of Shmuel ben Nachmeni is very difficult in terms of our level of interpretation or ability to interpret or to understand Tanakh. So in between these, there's what I call the Kosav Ashlishi, right? There's the golden path in between. And I would have to argue that what you're getting tonight is a kind of a 1-foot summary of a mini course in Parshanut. But I would argue that if you want the sources, I'm happy to provide them. The primary approach to biblical exegesis, Parshanut, historically from the time of the Gaonim, really through all of the period of the Rishonim and up until more or less contemporary times, maybe the last 100 or 200 years, was neither like the first opinion nor like the Chazon Ish, but was much more discerning to take each case by itself and understand it on its own level. And so I want to show you a host of sources to that question. And as I said, it starts in the story of the Gaonim, so we're going to start from Rav Shvira Gaon, Rav Shmuel Hanagid, early Rishonim, early period of the Gaonim, that wrote the following. So Rav Shvira Gaon is writing about the distinction between halachic material in the Talmud and midrashic or agadic material in the Talmud. And that's more or less where this discussion revolves. Because at the end of the day, we are bound by the rabbi's interpretation of halacha. Are we not equally bound by their interpretation of text and Tanakh? That's the question at the core of it. Says of Shvirga, Katav of Shvirga b'Megilat Sdamim al-inyan ha'agadot, with regards to agada or midrashic material. Hanimili denafke mipsuke, those things that Chazal say that emerge from text, umikre midrash v'agada, that are called midrash or agada, umdana ninhu, they are the rabbi's assessment, personal opinions. V'lachein, ein sumchin al agada, we are not bound in a legal sense by their interpretation of these agadot. V'yomru ein lemedim min agadot, you can't learn halachic material from the agada. והנכון מהם מה שמתחזק מן השכל ומן המקרא נקבל. Those things that are logical, that emerge, that are logical to understand, and that emerge from the text in what they are saying, that we can accept. ואין סוף ותחילה לאגדות. There's no limit. There's an infinite number of אגדות. And so if you start to be literal in every agada and every midrash that you're going to find, you're going to find yourself swimming in a sea of that's impossible to navigate. So his basic premise is, and this is really our starting point, is that the rabbis are not getting this interpretation from a tradition or masoret that comes from Har Sinai, that comes down as part of Torah Shebaal Peh. They're looking at text and offering the same kind of insight or understanding that we are offering when we look at the text. And therefore, if their interpretation is logical, mitchazek min asechel, textually supported, min amikra, then we are happy to accept it. But if not, then we are not obligated to do so. So says Rav Shvira Gaon, and it's quite a point of departure. Shmuel HaNagid, part of the early Rishonim, wrote an introduction to the Talmud. Now, this introduction appears in the back of every Shas. So in the Gemara in Brachos, the first volume of every Gemara, if you look in the back where all the Rishonim are, you will find this is referred to as the Mavoa Talmud, the introduction to study of Talmud, Vayera Shmuel and Nagid. And he defines every aspect of Talmudic study. What is a Medrash? What is a Nekimta? What is a Braita? What is a Mishnah? Methodologically, what do each thing, these things mean? And he gets to the word Haggadah, homiletics, or Haggadah, as we would call it. Says Shmuel HaNagid, Kol perush yavo b'Talmud, any interpretation that appears in the Talmud, al shuminyan, on any matter, shelo yehiye mitzvah, that is not halachic in nature, that is not legalistic in nature. Zuhi Haggadah, that is defined as Haggadah. Okay, so what is Haggadah, or Haggadah, or Midrash, as we refer to it? It is an analysis of text that is not legalistic, not halachic in nature. Right. Is that clear? What is the status of that volume of work, which is integrated into the Talmud? Ein lecha lilmod mimena ela ma she'yale al hadat. The only part of it that is binding, the only thing you can need to learn from it is that which is compelling logically, that which is logical. Anything that Chazal say with regards to a mitzvah, with regards to a halacha, has the status of immutable law that comes down to its part of Torah Shebaal Peh all the way back to Hasina. You can't add to it, you can't detract from it. If it is legal, it is halachic, it is binding, it is immutable. Whereas that which Chazal offered as an insight into interpretation of text that is not halachic, kol echad kifi sheniz damenlo, is not based on a masoret or a tradition back to Sinai, but rather is the personal insight of each of the rabbis in the Talmud. Like Rav, who said of Rebbe, that Rebbe, because he was a descendant of David HaMelech, sought to seek an interpretation that was more favorable to David. It's not because there was a Masoret to that effect from Har Sinai. Mashra Abadato, whatever they sought, and whatever they saw in the text. Something is logical, and in this interpretation, we can accept it. The Hashar is for the rest, and some Kamalim, they don't have to rely on them.
What about Rashi?
Same thing with Rashi. I'll show you something interesting about Rashi. But Rashi is no different from the rest of them. That which is compelling, that which is logical, we should accept. That which is not, just because it says it in Rashi, just because it says it in Medrash, not obligated to interpret it that way.
Some people might disagree with that.
It has to be this way, because if it wasn't, there'd be no room for multiple commentaries. How could you have, and if you open up a Mikra Kedolot, you have Rashi's interpretation, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, Sfornach, Hizkuni, Rabag, you have a gazillion different Mefarshim who explain things to each one differently. If there was one Masoret that came out of the Gemara, then they would all be bound to interpret the same way. But there isn't. So Rashi says, for example, that we were in Egypt for 210 years, because that's what the Medrash says. And the Ramban says, no, text says we were in Egypt for 400 years. We were in Egypt for 400 years. And so on and so forth. Rashi says, yeah, Eliezer was 12 at the Akedah, because that's what the Medrash says. And the Ramban says he was, or the Medrash says he was 23, I think, or 30. Right? It depends on where he was. One interpretation says he was only three. He was a child. Every commentary offered their own interpretation and insight into the text. If it was non-halachic, it was not binding. And therefore, the room was there to analyze the text. The freedom was there. That's the basic premise, certainly relevant to the time of the Gaonim, certainly relevant to the time of the Rishonim. It doesn't become a polemic really until contemporary times. I'm going to skip the Sefer HaChinuch, but he basically says the same thing. And I'm going to... Or Chaim HaKadosh, who also says the same thing, Reshut Lanu Nituna Lafi Mashmut HaKtuvim, the permission is given to us in our interpretation of text, B'Nitivut HaIyun V'Yishivadat, with careful analysis and study, Agam Shekadmuna Rashanim V'Yeshvu Bofen Acher, even if early commentaries offered interpretation that was different, Shivim Panim HaTorah, there are 70 avenues to the study of Torah. And we're not commanded, we're not instructed not to follow in the days of, in the path of the Rishonim when it comes to interpretation of text. Basically what the Orach Chaim HaKadosh says. What I want to take you in the final few minutes of our shir today, what I want to introduce you to is one of the most famous statements of the Rashbam. Debbie, you asked me about Rashi. So Rashi is a really good example. Because on the one hand, Rashi himself writes that in his analysis of Chumash and in his commentary, he is coming to offer an interpretation that is Liyashev Pshuto Shel Mikra, says Rashi, of himself, to analyze and to offer an interpretation that resolves the simple reading of the text, what I have often referred to as text in context, pshat. And he adds to include midrashic material when it helps resolve a textual issue. And to midrashic material, if it is relevant or helpful to an understanding of the text. So says Rashi about himself. I actually meant to find that quote, and I didn't do it before the class, so I will, if you want, I'll find it for you afterwards. But that's, Rashi says it in Sefer Bereishit, and he says it in several places. That Ani labati el liyashev pshuto shel mikra. My goal is to interpret the pshat. Medrash, it's fine, beautiful. Yafani parshazu, yafani dresha, medrash tanchumas, says Rashi. This parsha has beautiful midrashic interpretations. But Ani labati el liyashev pshuto shel mikra. My goal is to interpret the simple reading. Now, we all know that Rashi relied heavily on Midrashim in his interpretation of Pshat. Meaning that on the one hand, we say Rashi himself, of his own commentary, says, I am coming to interpret Pshat, not Midrash, unless the Midrash helps me in understanding Pshat. On the other hand, Rashi relied heavily on Pshat. I can tell you that one of the lessons I learned many years ago from Nechama Leibowitz, Zichrona Livracha, was she spent pretty much the primary focus of her educational career was to understand Rashi's methodology in his quotations of Midrash. She actually wrote an entire volume for a two-volume work, which is a university course in the study of Rashi and his methodology through the Open University. And part of it is to understand Rashi's approach to Midrash. When does he quote Midrash? When does he not quote Midrash? When does he quote partial Midrash? When does he change the language of a Midrash? At the end of the day, there's been volumes written, commentary upon commentary, on understanding Rashi's approach to Tanakh. I think there are more commentaries on Rashi than there are on, I think Nechama once said, there are more commentaries on Rashi than there are commentaries on Shakespeare. So it's just an observation. So let me introduce you to the Rashbam. The Rashbam, Shmuel Rabbi Meir, was Rashi's grandson. And the Rashbam wrote a commentary on Chumash in which he very often argued with Rashi's interpretation because Rashi was too reliant on Medrash and he offered interpretations that were much more textual. Okay, so I have Rashi's interpretation, Rashbam, you can debate which one's closer to Pshat on any story in Tanakh. But in one particular place, the Rashbam writes, you know, it's hard to imagine these, we think of these people as acronyms. We think of Rashi as Rashi. We think of Rashbam as Rashbam. It's hard to imagine these people as stories, lives. You know, I once heard from J.J. Schachter, you know, when Rashi was 5 years old, his mother didn't call him Rashi. His mother didn't come to call him to dinner and say, come Rashila. You know, he had a name, he had a life, he had a story. These people were real people. But we know them by their acronyms and we know them by their books. There's a very famous story of a gentleman, a professor of history at Hebrew University by the name of Jacob Katz, Dr. Jacob Katz, who wrote many, many books in history, but he was once lecturing and describing the tendency amongst Jews to name people after the books that they wrote. So the Chazon Ish is called the Chazon Ish because he wrote a sefer called Chazon Ish, right? We name people after the books that they wrote. The Aruch Lener is called the Aruch Lener, even though his name was Yaakov Ettlinger, because he wrote a book called the Aruch Lener. So we call people by the books that they wrote, the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim wasn't called the Chafetz Chaim when he was 10 years old. His mother didn't say, come Chafetz Chaim, come to dinner. Right? He had a name. He saw a mayor. He was called, we call him the Chafetz Chaim because he wrote a book called Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim is particularly interesting because he wrote four books. He wrote the Chafetz Chaim, and he wrote the Mishnah Berurah, and he wrote the Bir Halacha, and we call him by the name of whatever book he wrote. So we say, the Mishnah Berurah writes, when referring to the same author as the Chafetz Chaim and the Bir Halacha. So the Bir Halacha writes, the Mishnah Berurah writes, and the Chafetz Chaim writes. It's all the same person. But we identify people by the name. So Jacob Katz was talking about this because he had just written, his last publication he wrote before he died was an analysis, the sociological analysis of Jews in Europe. And he was afraid that he would be named after the title of his last book. The last book is entitled The Shabbos Goy. So he didn't want to be known historically as The Shabbos Goy, The Shabbos Goy Zucht. So that was a very famous story. But the Rashbam is nonetheless the Rashbam. And he wrote the following about his grandfather, Rashi. Eila told it Yaakov, beginning of Parsha told it. Yaskilu v'yavinu ohavai. Listen, my children. Shekol mashilimdunu raboteinu. When our rabbis taught us that ein mikra yotze midei pshuto, that the text of the Tanakh has a meaning and a value to its study on its own merit. What I refer to often as text and context. Af ki ikara shel Torah, even though the primary purpose of Torah, its primary agenda, is through nuance and interpretation to give us the halacha in every aspect of the dinim in the Torah of the mitzvot, extra words, or 32 midot of Rabbi Eliezer ben Osher ben Yosef Glili, or the 13 midot of Bishmol, Kavachomer, and Gzeres Shava. Those are the primary tools of Torah Shebaal Peh, the primary tools of halachic exegesis. That is the primary purpose of Tanakh, of Torah. However, Harishonim, mitoch chasidutam, because of the piety of earlier generations, says the Rashbam in the 12th century, nit askul in tot acharei drashot shehin ikar, because of their piety, they spent most of their time talking about or now analyzing the halachic drashot of the text. Umitoch kach lo hugulu ba'omek pshuto shemikra. They were not well versed. They were not well experienced in the analysis of the simple reading of the text. They didn't have the frame of reference. They were just engaged all their time in the study of halach, not in pshat. And similarly, don't study philosophy, and all kinds of other statements related to this. They felt that it was of secondary importance. I'm going to skip a little bit. So, therefore, says the Rashbam, they weren't so experienced in the study of Pshat. As it says in Meshechet Shabbat, I have 18 years I studied in the Beis Medrash. I didn't know that ein mikra yotze midei pshuto, that there's a Pshat that's legitimate in the interpretation of text, one of the Ramayim said. All right, all that's background. Now we get to the key piece. V'gam Rabbeinu Shlomo Avi Imi Meir Einei Agola. Rabbeinu Shlomo, the father of my mother, right? Rishbam is Rishmul ben Meir, but his mother was not in his name, was Rashi's daughter. Rishbam was Rashi's grandson from his mother's side. So Rabbeinu Shlomo, Avi Imi, my maternal grandfather, Meir Ne'agola, who illuminated the eyes of the entire diaspora with his interpretation, Shepiresh Torah, Nevi'im, Ktuvim, who interpreted the Torah and Nevi'im and Ktuvim, Natan Lev Lefavesh Pshuto Shemikla. He wanted to teach Pshat. He set out to express, to teach Pshat. That's what Rashi says of himself. I've come for the purpose of explaining Pshat. This is the key. Be'afani, I too, Shmuel b'Rabbi Meir, Chotno, Shmuel, son of Rabbi Meir, Rashi's son-in-law. His father is Rashi's son-in-law. Nitvakachti imo lefanav. I fought with him. I struggled with him. I debated with him. Now, picture that for a second. At the Friday night dinner table, Rashi with his grandson. His grandson is 10 years old. Rashi is Rashi. Rashi wrote something in his commentary, and his 15-year-old grandson is arguing with him. That's not pshat. And Rashi says it is pshat. And the Rashbam says, no, it's not. Having a whole debate over the Friday night dinner table about what the pshat is. Nitvakachtim, I fought with him. I struggled with him. Argued with him. And the Hodali, says the Rashbam, my grandfather admitted to me, she'ilu hayalo pnai, if he had had the time at the end of his life, hayat tzirich lasot perushim acherim, he would have rewritten his perush. He would have rewritten his commentary. Lefi hapshatot hamidchadshim b'chol yom, in accordance with the new insights of pshat that are being noveled and introduced every day. And that's his introduction to his discussion. So some say it's very self-serving. He wants you to accept his interpretation over Rashi's interpretation. So he says, Rashi admitted to me that he would have, that I was right. Right, which is, okay, in a certain sense, self-serving. But what it does tell me is that from the Gaonim through the Rishonim up until really the Malbim, up until contemporary times, any commentary on Chumash that has ever written a new insight has done so more or less with the freedom of knowing that we are not bound by the rabbinic interpretation of Tanakh. Now, there's a takeaway from all of this, and you've heard me say it before, but I wanted you to see the sources upon which it's based. And the takeaway from all of this is the following phrase, and I've coined it, I've used it many times. And that is that Midrashim, in all of their facets, do not necessarily have to be taken literally, but they always have to be taken seriously. Meaning, before we can approach any text, certainly the story of David, but really any text, we need to know how Chazal dealt with it. We need to seriously assess the question of the pshat in their words, and then to determine in our course of our study whether we want to approach that, take that approach, or a different approach, or whether or not something else completely. But in all cases, Midrashim were not flippant. They weren't arbitrary. They were Chazal with all of their the integrity and intensity that brings, but they're not necessarily binding. And that's the key piece. Whereas halachic literature of Chazal are binding on us philosophically and halachically, because that's what we buy into, a system of Torah Sheval Peh that comes down to our Sinai, from our Sinai. The foundation of all of the Gaonim and all of the Rishonim is that interpretation of text is not halachic, but that is narrative, is not bound by the same limitations as the interpretation of halach. That doesn't mean that we flippantly dismiss it, but it does mean that we have an obligation to take it seriously, but not necessarily literally or binding, or as the sole legitimate interpretation of a story. That's the background. I've done a lot of talking tonight. I appreciate you listening, but but I wanted to put this out there because our approach to studying David HaMatsheva is going to take three stages. Stage one is a little bit of this background. We're going to go back to, we're going to start with the issue of Chazal and how they saw David and analyze two things. Number one, is Shmuel ben Achmeni a monolithic worldview? Meaning, we talk about Chazal as a group that spans almost 1,000 years of rabbinic interpretation. Is Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni, who's an extreme position, is he the only position? Or were there others in the world of Chazal? And are we dealing with a debate within rabbinic literature? That's question number one. Question number two, even within the world of Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni, who seems to say things that fly in the face of the text. What was he driving at? What was he trying to tell us? Do I take Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni literally? Or was he trying to drive a certain message in terms of our understanding of the story? And after we've established all of that, which will take us the better part of next week and maybe part of the week after, but not more, then we're going to go back and start the story piece by piece, but with this background in place, to kind of look at the text and look at the story and go back and forth and try to see what we do with David HaMelech and Natan HaNavi and Uriah HaChiti and Batsheva and everybody else involved. That's more or less what I have to share for tonight.
Can I clarify one thing?
Yeah, by all means.
Okay, so when you say that it's about the narrative, we don't have to take it literally. So, right. But when it's about the commandment, the mitzvah, then we do. So if somebody says, well, I heard through my teacher that we have to do X, Y, and Z, that has to be taken literally. But if they say,
So what you hear people say is a different issue. In other words, halacha operates by its own parameters. So we have a Gemara, we have a Mishnah, we have a Gemara. We are bound by the Masoret of halacha. But that doesn't mean that halacha is also monolithic, right? There are multiple views within halachic literature as well. So sometimes you can have nuances of opinion and different issue applications, etc. But they are assessed and dealt with and paskined based on one set of rules. Whereas parshanut, or biblical exegesis, works by a different set of rules. I'll give you an example. If I have a machloket in the Gemara as to the definition of, let's take a relevant issue to today's world in St. Louis, where the Erev is, right? Definition of an Erev or a Tzuat HaPetach. I have a machloket. Whatever the machloket, it's a halachic debate. So I'm obligated to address the question from within the rules of halacha. There are rules to how we paskin, there are rules to how we derive and conclude certain halachic principles, assessing all the various nuances, and we deal with things that way. Whereas, if we're dealing with a question of a text and whether or not to be taken literally, let's take the Medrash that says that Rivka was 3 years old when she met Yitzchak. Okay, the Medrash. She was 3 years old when she met Yitzchak. Or that Abraham was 3 years old when he discovered God. If I'm reading Sefer Bereishit, do I have an obligation to, or I'm teaching Sefer Bereishit, do I have an obligation to read, interpret, or teach that Midrash, or can I offer an insight based on my understanding of the text? And I think the basic conclusion is we have much more freedom. I wouldn't say total freedom, but much more freedom of interpretation when it comes to parshanut or exegesis of text that is non-halachic than we do in halachic literature. I'll give you another example. We refer to midrash as a kind of a generic statement. Midrash, the Medrash says, okay, one of the things that, one of the publications that drives me bonkers more than anything else is a publication by Art School called The Medrash Says. And the reason why it drives me crazy is because they literally take midrashim and read them as biblical stories. but they're not. They're an interpretation of text, and there's many, and there are multiple ways of, my different polemic. But Midrash itself is divided into two literatures. There's what we call Midrash Halacha and Midrash Agada. There are four books of Midrash referred to as Midrash Halacha. And there are a gazillion books of Midrash that are collected homiletic teachings called Midrash Agada. Midrash Halacha is a halachic foundation is very specific. It's very specifically, there's four texts, the Sifra, Sifrei, and the Mechilta, and they are specific to each of the Chumashim, Shmos, Vayikra, Bamidbar, Dvarim, and they form the foundation of the Mishnah and the Gemara. We refer to them as Midrash. Rashi quotes them all the time as Midrash, but they are Midrash Halacha. And then there's a different body of literature that is more homiletic in these kinds of interpretations and stories, which we refer to also as the word Midrash, but there we're referring to Midrash Agada, or homiletic interpretation. So even within the world of rabbinic literature, the distinction exists between the world of halacha and the world of agada. Or so to call a book the Midrash says is very misleading, because you don't know which Midrash you're dealing with, halachic Midrash or agadic Midrash. It's a whole different issue. So anyway, I hope that helps clarify the issue.
Yes, thank you. Thanks very much. Because I feel like there are definitely a lot of people who will say, you have to believe this because, you know, it's you're obligated to believe this because it's a Midrash and that's just what we believe.
Correct. As I said at the beginning of my remarks, there is a very large school of thought today amongst in the religious world that more or less follows the approach of the Chazon Ish, which is to take every word of the Talmud, Midrashic, Agadic nature at face value and not allow any interpretation beyond it. That exists. It is a common approach. I prefer a more nuanced approach, but I do acknowledge that as an educational philosophy, that approach exists within the religious world today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you very much.
I hope
much.
This was helpful. I know it was a little bit out of our style, but I hope it was helpful to you.
Thank you. Bye.